get it. It's also been used in some villages to purchase communal property, which would be like large fishing boats. Quite a few of our villages have gone and purchased 40-foot boats that they could use for communal harvesting activities. If a particular resource is lacking in one area, they can also use these funds to pay for the transport costs and do a food exchange with another village. So, but these funds are all internally regulated. One thing we found was that MUTTAC is something that we like so much. We found that the villages, by using these funds, were putting a great deal of pressure on the whales. So we made a rule that none of the villages can buy or could use these funds to purchase or subsidize anything to do with whaling, because it was putting too much pressure on the whale resources we had. That's about the only overall condition that's been agreed by the villages or has been needed to be agreed upon at this time.
Could, just before we have questions from others, I think Sam Silverstone mentioned this, but how many Inuit are in the region?
There's about 5,000 Inuit in the region. As I said, that the population is growing very, very quickly. Over half of that population is under the age of 12. Now, if you start projecting this for the next 10 years, the labor market is going to increase tremendously over the next few years. The availability of modern technology to wildlife activities and the making kill rates and kill success on hunting activities is going to it's increasing all the time. So the impact of the population growth is going to be tremendous on the services, on the economy of the whole region. We're going to all of a sudden within 10 years, less than 10 years, we're going to have a labor pool which is already twice the size of what we have now. And the population growth doesn't seem to be slowing down at all. And we may be only about 5,000 now, but we're going to quickly outgrow the resources we do have now. And so looking forward, we see some problems that are going to happen with this.
The Crees, who made their settlement at the same time as you did, how many Crees are there, approximately?
10,000. About 7,000 Crees.
And what is the total in square miles of the region covered by the Inuit and the Crees by the settlement?
Okay, the total area, I can't give it to you in square miles, but I can give you an idea what size it is. It's 1/3 of the province of Quebec. The area covered by the Inuit, north of the 55th, which is roughly half this area, is about the same square mileage as the country of France.
Well, that gives us a pretty good idea. Just one last thing. What is the non-native population in the Inuit region?
It varies from village to village. The larger centers would have a larger non-native population, but in total, I think there's less than 1,000 in the entire region.
I see. And the regional government and the regional school board have certain guarantees under legislation, but they are non-ethnic. Did
yes.
I get that right?
Yes. To give you an example of how governments could control or take away whatever autonomy you may have on paper through money, in the area of education, although now that this is under our own control, what the Quebec government has said is, okay, on paper we have rights to adopt whatever kind of curriculum we want. We are supposed to be able to include all these native courses and things like this. But we've never been given enough funds to be able to develop our own native curriculum. In fact, what we've had to do was to use some of the funds that is used to train our own teachers, native teachers, to use some of those funds to do some of the curriculum development. So on paper, we have the right to create a native curriculum, but they won't give us the funds to do it. So, but we're trying to, we're slowly making progress in this area, but what you get in an agreement such as this may not necessarily what you'll end up with. You'll get it on paper. It depends. The financial resources are so critical to these questions. If you end up with a form of government that has to continually receive subsidies from the outside, the fiscal arrangements have to be worked out very carefully so that you don't end up in the problem that we did, where they effectively control you by earmarking every dollar that comes into your region.
Right. Yeah, well, thank you. Now, questions? Rosita Worrell, Chuck Smythe?
Well, I was very interested in some of the comments you made. They some of them echoed what we had heard a couple weeks ago, comments by Alaskans who have had some of the same experiences, particularly the problem with corporations not providing the economic benefits to the villages, and also that the level of expectations of return from corporations and other provisions of the Act were much higher than indeed has turned out. My first question has to do with that issue of the corporation and the level of employment and other benefits it has provided to the villages. And that is, I wondered if, you know, what kinds of solutions are you considering, or if there is a solution to that?
Well, on here, I won't give you the party line, but I'll give you my own personal opinion on the issue. I think the approach to economic development have been basically wrong in the sense that we've always tried to, when we try to do economic development, we try to do the Western version of economic development. The problem, if we want to do some real long-term and economic benefit for our communities, what we should be doing is developing and industrializing the traditional economy. Now, the problem here is that we run right into the government regulations again. The governments of Canada and of Quebec have always viewed the wildlife resources as something towards recreational activities. They are willing to pay farmers not to grow wheat, but they won't pay us to stop hunting seals. You know, these types of arguments start coming out. There's, if they looked at the wildlife resources in the same sense that they as a food resource as opposed to a recreational activity, or something that you preserve for the sake of looking at it, or for the sake of preservation. If they looked at it more on the lines of the management that they put into the fisheries and into agriculture, and put the same kind of priority and the same kind of funding for developing that resource, I think this would make a better and a longer term impact in our communities, as opposed to setting up, I don't know, another hamburger stand in one of our villages to compete with his neighbor, and then both of them are failing businesses, so we got to bring in more subsidies to try and keep these failing enterprises going. This is often the case in many, many tries that the government has put out. They would set up a small business, and since they got government money in it, they got to keep it from failing, so they keep putting in subsidies into it through various means, and this type of economic development creates a very artificial economy. If you take a look at the example of what's developed in Greenland, not to say that everything is perfect in Greenland, but the level of modernization and industrialization of the traditional economy there is something to be envied. Once they set up like the processing plants and for handling the wildlife, the wild meats and things like this, you end up with the spin-off jobs that are more permanent, such as the spin-off jobs in the processing plants, in the retailing of these products and things like that. So that I think it would be a more natural economy and should be the one that should be given more emphasis at this time, as opposed to trying to transplant the southern or western economy to the north.
Peter Atinwar, did you have a question, Peter? And then Steve, and then Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make an observation. First of all, as a Canadian Eskimo or Inuk, one thing that the NQIA Makivik process did was produce a high number of highly skilled Eskimo politicians who have helped Eskimos in other parts of Canada. I don't think anyone in here would disagree with me that Mark is a pretty highly skilled person. I'd like to make another observation. That was the Kativik Regional Government is one of the two models in Canada which is supposed to be eventually a non-ethnic or public government or government by majority through an election process. However, I used to note over the door of the Makivik offices in Fort Chimo a sign saying an ethnic organization representing an ethnic community. I'd like Mark to reconcile those two those two views. And one more flippant, perhaps frivolous question: if you could do it all over again, would you do it, Mark?
Okay. On the first question, Makivik has become the ethnic entity that is set up. One of the unique features of Makivik as well is that it has the legal responsibility to protect the native rights of its membership.
That's the corporation.
So it has this unique role attached to it. So that's why the corporation's always getting involved in politics. It's not strictly a business corporation. There's this one side of it that we've given the legal responsibility to act like a trustee for its members. And it, by its charter, it must protect the native rights, especially the rights contained in the James Bay Agreement. But we've expanded that view to encompass all of our interests and rights. The regional government is the form or the governmental institution we've adopted to be able to deliver services and to do some of the regulatory activities in our region. What we tried to do was not to put all our eggs in one basket. So that's why you see that sign over the Makivik door. The other question, whether I would do it all over again. Yes, I certainly would, but now we'd at least wouldn't. If we did it again, we wouldn't be running full speed trying to pick up the golden apples as we're running. The other native groups in Canada have now the luxury of time. They can actually study what they're getting into. We had to jump right into the water, and then we found out how cold it was. This is...
You turned out to be a pretty good swimmer, I think.
But the thing about the James Bay Agreement and the whole process was not the amounts that we received. The real prize, the real benefit of the whole thing was not the dollars, was not the land, was not necessarily the definition of the rights. The real prize in the whole thing was that it broke the barrier of apathy that was developing in our villages. It organized them as communities. It gave them a common issue to be able to deal with. It motivated the people to do things. Even when we disagreed, even when we're disagreeing, at least we're not apathetic about the situation. Before, it seemed so hopeless. The native people had no jobs. They just very beholding to governments and things like this. Then, after this had the whole process, and despite what we received or didn't receive in the agreement, it mobilized the people to actively start participating in trying to change government policy, trying to deal with their own problems as opposed to waiting for the government to come along and solve them for them. So I've always maintained that this is the real prize in the whole thing. It wasn't the money, it wasn't the land. It was the motivation and the drive that it put into our own people.
Steve Iveson.
One of the comments you made this morning was that you were creating new communities. People were moving back out to more traditional areas. And as you mentioned yesterday, that goes against the recent flow of history. Government has been bringing people more and more into communities by pressure for schools or providing services. And at the same time, people, I imagine, I don't know in your situation, but maybe there's a generation that got a bit used to living in those communities with those particular levels of services. So I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about the factors that have motivated people to move back out.
You see, the existing villages we're living in, with the exception of a very few, like Chimo's been a trading post for well over 200 years. And there's a few villages that have had this long establishment. But for the most part, the villages as they are now today were non-existent until the late 50s, early 60s. So what motivates them to move back? They're homesick. That's basically it. They want to go back to their traditional areas, the areas that they're accustomed to. There's also, by people being forced into these villages, I mean, they weren't literally picked up and put there, but the pressures were very tremendous for them to move into these centralized places. By this happening, it created the social atmosphere where in the village, they actually operated as two villages inside one town. Because the social structures, the traditional power structures in the village, and all of that were still left them as distinct villages, even though they were living in one town. So it's very natural for them to separate out and go back to their areas. We haven't been in these villages so long that we've grown such a strong attachment to it. The village of Leaf Bay was created just before the James Bay Agreement was signed, and that split off from the people from Fort Chimo. The village of Akudlivik was split off from the village of Kanyasuk. Aupaluk came from Kanyasuk. POV split up, and another village was formed called Akudlivik. But these are people moving back to their traditional areas. It's not going out and establishing new villages necessarily. It's just relocating old ones.
What kind of expectations do people have for the kind of community they'll have, services, this kind of thing, and what size are the new communities being set up, or the old ones being reestablished, and education? What's the impact on education?
Well, the average size of our villages generally is around 300 people. The new villages that are being set up are usually about 150, 100 people. Initially, this is the numbers that would be establishing the villages. Now, in terms of services, the James Bay Agreement states that if there's a village of over 50 people, then it could be erected as a municipality. Now, once it's a municipality, then the government is obliged to give it the full run of services. We often go into quite lengthy negotiations trying to establish these villages. There's one village that was created directly through the James Bay Agreement, and that was the people of Great Whale. They relocated about half their population to a new area, or to an old area, I should say. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. So the schools would go into those communities too. People would not see themselves in their view, perhaps.
Yes, they would get the schools, they'd get the nursing station, they'd get the municipal services. All of that would go in with it. But initially, they have to go through the rough times as well. One thing they have to do is more or less demonstrate to the governments that there are actually people moving there, and there's usually the first 50 or so people that move have to live through pretty hard times for a few years, and then once they show that, demonstrate that they're serious, then the government will bring in their services.
So this plan is an important aspect in your idea about stressing the traditional economy and modernizing it and exploiting that instead of moving into the more Western economy.
It's a very natural evolution to our villages. You could try to control it by regulation or by trying to put financial constraints on the villages so that this wasn't possible, but I think it would occur in any event.
Shorty O'Neill.
I just want you to expand a bit on the education system that you're going on, and a bit more on the health. Probably what I should explain, I suppose, what's happening over in our region, and give you a bit of an idea what I'm talking about. In the past 10 years, we've started to set up Aboriginal run and control schools back at the community level. And, you know, we've never ever got any money to kick these things off. And usually we maybe get some money from overseas or from the east of Australia, enough to pay maybe two teachers. But what happens is that the community forms a committee, and it's usually the elders, the old people, because they've been the traditional teachers since the beginning of time. And the school is run probably more than 50% on traditional teaching, because we believe that our children have, as a first right, have the right to traditional education. And the elders do this because it's an obligation by them. They don't get paid for it. And sometimes we get to employ a couple of white school teachers who teach what we see as important in the European curriculum. Like this, probably about 90% you can throw out the door because it doesn't apply to Indigenous people. But we also realise that we need the tools to be able to live beside a foreign society, but we're forced to live beside. And so we need these tools to deal with it. And the elders then decide what comes out of the European curriculum and what's taught to our children. And usually, like Yiparinya in Alice Springs, which teaches about 10 different languages as first languages, English becomes a 11th language. It's been operating for about 5 years up until November, where we finally got it recognised by the new government in Australia, and it's now been government funded. But it operated for over 4.5 years on charity, and very little charity. And so even some of the white school teachers had to get half pay most of the time. That's why I need you to go on a bit. And I just can't understand why you don't have money to fix up a curriculum. But the other thing on the health situation also, with health statistics that we've got, and we've probably got some of the worst in the world, we also believe it's pretty important to have good health, because once we get our land back, we want some people alive to be able to live on it. And so health is also a pretty major thing within the movement. And we now have 38 health organisations throughout Australia, which isn't much when you look at the size of Australia and the number of Aboriginal communities throughout the whole country. But these 38 are now funded by the federal government. And the way we got them funded was we got a little bit of money from wherever we could get it and set a health service up and then done a survey into the health statistics around the place and blew it up wherever we could, utilised the media all over the country, utilised the international media, blew it up particularly in Europe, and started getting people to, you know, send donations from Europe over, getting as many people as we could to embarrass the Australian government so that they would start to fund those health organisations. And as we got one funded, then we'd move into another region and set another one up and embarrass them all over again and continue on in that field. And yeah, that's, I'm just wondering, you know, well, why you can't put a curriculum up because you haven't got any money. You know, we do it without money.
There has been quite a bit of, this is one of the two areas that the government had put in quite a bit of priority even before we went into the claims movement and all of this. So there, despite the blunderings and all of this, there was a fair bit of money already being put into these things, but we had no control of them. So what we were basically doing was taking over already existing programs and services. That the way we've set up our schools, they have to be able to fall into the same criteria as all the schools in throughout the province. They have to be able to you have the same high school levels and all of this. So, and our the way the education system has evolved is that we've took over basically the Western education system, and then we're starting to interject our traditional stuff into it, which seems to be, I think, the opposite of what your development has been. But so there's not that much material written in Inuttitut, and the problem is that even though in Greenland they've had books and everything written for the last couple hundred years, the only thing until very recent times that you could find written in Inuttitut was the Bible. Other than that, there wasn't too much other reading material, and then in more recent times it's been only political documents, so that's still not something that you could put into the schools. And so we've had to try and develop and try to get the written material for the schools, and that's slowly evolving, but it's very slow because of the lack of funds directly to be able to do the research work, to go down to the museums and the universities in the south that have gathered all the tapes about our traditions and all the traditional stories and the songs and all that are in all these libraries all over the south, and you know, we don't have any access to them. They're 1,000 miles away. So we need the funds to be able to develop our curriculums and to try and move this on further. And also to try and train more native teachers as well, because the teachers have to be certified as teachers. In the sense of the same way that teachers are certified for the regular schools in the south. So this is the reason why we need the additional money to be able to do the curriculum development. We're putting it in, even though that there is some traditional courses being put in now. They're also teaching the younger boys and that to go out hunting, to learn the basic skills of hunting and things like that. And this is a part of the school system now. So things are moving along, but not to the extent that we would like them. Much like yourself, when we used to go to the schools, when I went to school, We used to also be punished for speaking our own language in school, and we were forbidden to speak in Inuktitut in the schools, and so it was definitely not a part of our curriculum. So we had to start from scratch, basically, in terms of trying to include our native culture into the education system. Now, in the area of health, here. The governments in Canada have put a good deal of emphasis on health services in the north, even though that they might not be as good as we would like them. They have improved tremendously over the last few years. And we've now got the administrative control over the hospitals. But the other thing that also really made a marked improvement on health services was the improvements in communication and transportation. We now, all of our villages have satellite hookups for telephones, for radio, and for TV. And this has really helped improve instant communications, has really helped improve health services. Also in the area of transportation, we own our own airline, and we've been able to increase the frequency of flights to our villages. Because the villages are so small, all you can really put into them is a small nursing station with central hospital in the larger centers. And so the question of transportation has also really made an improvement to that. Now that we own our own airline, we equip them better than the previous airlines used to have. Our villages don't have any real runways or any navigational aids on the ground, so we've taken the bother to invest computer navigation systems into our aircraft. That means an additional $35,000 for each airplane. But this is supposed to be a secondary navigational system. But we use it more like a primary system because there's no on-the-ground navigational aids. So, but the improvement in air services has made health services really good, because we can, if there's an emergency in one of our smaller villages, we can have them evacuated and sent to the south in a matter of hours as opposed to days. And this has really made the difference.
Rosita Worrell, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I found your review very informative, and certainly many parallels to Alaska. Might share with you a few observations and then ask you just one question. In Alaska, where in the Native corporations, primarily Native corporations, we have the studies that have been done shows that we have the same problem, that the rate of Native participation is very low, even in those corporations that have a priority to hire shareholders or Native people, and really have an aggressive recruitment program, are lucky to have about a 20% Native participation. That's in corporations as employees, as opposed to Native tribal service organizations where you have a higher Native employment. In one situation, we found the apparent discrimination that you note in the differences in benefits to the non-Native employees. In one instance here in Alaska, we found that teacher aides were getting benefits such as housing, and the Native people living in the communities weren't. And so a discrimination suit was brought through the human rights. And before it was ever resolved, we noticed a mass hiring of Native teacher aides and given the same kind of benefits. I don't know if you want to go that route, since I guess you own most of the Native corporations. The second thing is that the studies, a number of studies that have been done in Alaska also have shown that where you have a modernization of traditional economies, there is a more rapid movement of Native people into those kind of economies, such as in Southeast Alaska, where you saw the Tlingit and Haidas moving into the fishing industry, but they were not as eager to participate in the timber industry. There have also been some studies that have shown, some studies and some actual things that have occurred where there have been changes in the supply side of the economic system. And I think the most successful probably is the North Slope Borough. They were fortunate in having some sort of agreement with the unions where they did not unionize their contracting, construction, carpenter jobs. But the most interesting thing that I found was that they changed their policies to really accommodate the subsistence economy. And for example, there was a real flexible leave system for subsistence hunting. The question that I have, it's something that we've noted here in Alaska, and it's causing us great grave concern, is the differential rate of change between male and female Native people. We have found that Native females are moving into wage economy at a much greater rate than Native males. We found that Native females are becoming educated, higher education, college education, at about three times the rate as Native males. And you know, we don't think that this leads to a healthy society. And we're wondering, you know, I mean, do you notice any those same kind of trends?
Okay, on your observation about discrepancy of what the Native people get on, for the same job as an imported person would. By looking at some of the statistics, we're finding that the people who have the least ability to pay, the ones that are on marginal wage-earning jobs and things like that, have to carry the highest costs. They pay a higher... a person who has... a job driving a truck in one of our villages will pay more for his housing, more for his food. He'll pay for his own trips if he wants to travel elsewhere and things like this. He has to carry higher costs than a skilled person with a higher salary. An imported person with a higher salary and all of that. So the economy in the villages is quite upside down. The people who have the greatest resources and the greatest ability to pay the least, which is weird. But this is the unfortunate evolution of how services have been evolving in the North, because the wage scales and the systems that were put in place were basically when the government used to bring in these men to hold the flag. And that when we took over the system, unfortunately, we continued this type of thing, and we have to try to rationalize it, or to make the subsidies spread over the entire population better, as opposed to having it concentrating on those high wage earners. On the question of Native women getting into the job market at a faster rate, I really can't say whether this is taking place, but the thing is that in our operations, we're finding, just a quick observation on this area, we find that the Native women in our area have been, on our training programs and that, we find more Native women are involved in areas of bookkeeping, finance, and basic administration, where the males would tend to concentrate more on the management and the political roles. This is the difference I would see in our villages, but the notion of equality has always been quite strong. In fact, right now, the president of Mikivik happens to be a woman at this time. I really haven't seen the education or the I know that the concentration in what they're going for is different, but I can't say that there are more Native women getting higher education than males. I can't say that, but I do notice that there is a difference in what the types of work that they're going after.
Could I just say that the next person on my list to ask a question is Dennis Patterson, and before becoming Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, Dennis Patterson was Minister of Education in the Northwest Territories, and you might respond to Rosita Worrell's question if you're in a position to do so, Dennis, and then carry on with your question you have for Mark. That is about men and women and levels of education and so on. Then I have Steve Kakfwi and Doug Sanders and Bill Erasmus down. And what I was going to suggest was that we break in just a moment for a quick cup of coffee, and that after that, we carry on with the questioning, and that perhaps we might, by 11:30, try to move on to the next subject, which is the Cope Settlement in the Mackenzie Delta, and to ask Dwight Noseworthy, who is the chief negotiator for the Northwest Territorial Government, to tell us about that settlement, and then move on to the CYI settlement. I think everybody wants to complete the sessions by late tomorrow afternoon, so I think I, as chairman, have to try to see if we can't keep moving, even though I've been forced to cut off the questioning of every single speaker so far. Just before we take a break, I would like Maureen to tell us about these artifacts that she was good enough to bring from Australia and to present to the Commission. And some of you haven't seen them, and during the coffee break you might like to come forward and take a look at them. But Maureen, why don't you come and sit here now and just tell everybody about these, and then we'll take our break.
Stanley knows more about this than me, but he's shy. This is a flogging stick, and it actually is used still in Australia. If you have a feud in Australia, especially with the tribal people, they usually pick up one of these, each person, and the first man down is out, of course. They each have a hit, and the other one must not hit while the other person is hitting. They have to stand and take it. And the women even use this, but this is not a woman's flogging stick. It's used for the men only. And it's still used in our country back in Australia. And we're supposed to be civilized. If you come up here later on, you can actually see this being used. It's called a spear thrower. And you can see down here where they actually put the spear in there, and it gives it greater throwing range, I guess. And that's it there being actually used. They usually use kangaroo hide, and that has got kangaroo sinews actually, to bind it there, and of course when it dries it sticks. And the same down here, that's got some sort of what would that be, Stanley?
Sugar bark wax.
Sugar?
Bark wax.
Sugar bark wax, that is there. And these are all hand carved. This is a koolaman, but this is one used for food. I have a really beautiful little picture here of one made out of bark with an Aboriginal child in it. It's a larger one, of course, and that's just made out of bark. But this one would be used for gathering food. That's called a koolaman. This is a didgeridoo. Stanley and Shorty both deny being able to play it. It's hollow up there, and for somebody who's a gas bag, they can really go to town on this one. All the carvings, of course, on the side mean something. I don't really know what, because I haven't been told what they are. There are some things that women are not allowed to know, so I guess that's one of them.
5 minutes for coffee. And, please come and take a look at these.
I don't know what this, she's not, there was some Australians that started off yesterday.